A few weeks ago, we released an episode called Navel Gazing, where we took some time to review a few survey results and reflect on the past year of podcasting. Now, since then, we've created a new survey designed to help us understand our listeners much better, and we made it available on our website, infantsonthrones.com. We plan to keep this up for the next several months, so if you haven't filled it out yet, please head over and make your opinions known. And we've also provided a link so that you can check out the running results if you're interested in that sort of thing. But one of the questions that we asked was whether or not you would want to be a guest on the podcast. And at this point, about half of you have said that you would. So the question is, how are we going to make that happen? So today's episode was created mainly for you. But hopefully, the rest of you will find it at least moderately interesting as well. There's one that's really great about you, Randy.
Aw.
Jackie starts gushing on Randy?
No.
Get in line.
Not exactly.
Someone who doesn't like me?
One who liked you very much on the Voices episode when you interviewed your dad, and liked you very much as the atheist from Mormon Stories.
Oh, brother. But
now they see you as a cautionary tale for aggressive and... What was the other adjective?
Jeez.
Okay, on a side note, I've enjoyed listening to Randy on other podcasts where he's interviewed his dad about his faith crisis, and I believe he did an atheism podcast on Mormon Stories that I really liked as well. He came across as a skeptic who still had compassion. However,
I don't have compassion.
However, the rampant cynicism and vulgar expression in his statements on Infants on Thrones comes across as aggressive and condescending. It You just held back a curse, didn't you? It makes me worry that my own disillusion with religion has me on the same road he seems to be progressing on. I'll take it as a cautionary tale.
Oh, God.
Here's my favorite part.
You self-righteous...
That said, all the best shows have a character you love to hate. Keep up the good work.
You know what? I don't want to be liked by you. On podcasts where I wasn't allowed to cuss, I'm fine. But once I cuss, oh, no.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund. Now, if you've noticed over the past few weeks, we've been trying to get more episodes out to you than we did last year. Now, this may or may not be a sustainable pace, but do you know what could probably help? Collaboration. Now, when we first started Infants on Thrones, we wanted to make it a group effort. We knew that I would create some episodes, and that Tom would create some episodes, and Bob and Jesse and Matt and Randy would create some episodes, and since we're all different people with different interests, we would create a lot of different kinds of episodes.
You know, each one of us is going to produce content here. And so,
right, yeah.
Like, the things that I do may be different than the things that Bob does, or Matt, or Randy, or Tom, or Jesse.
I hope so.
Why is that, Tom?
I hope that my stuff's going to be different than yours.
You don't want it to be the same?
No, because I don't want, you know, we're going to lose listeners when they listen to your stuff, and then I have to gain them back when they listen to my stuff.
Yeah.
Well, think of today's episode as a different kind of open invitation for all of you, the listeners, to collaborate with us and help us create some new episodes as well. Now, it's one thing to ask you listeners to give us topics that you want to hear. That's easy. And of course, if you want to do that, you can do that, and maybe eventually we'll get around to them. But we'd like to try something a little more involved as well. And at this point, I want to be sure to give credit to John Larson and to Mormon Expression, because John was very collaborative and inclusive in his approach. He's probably the main reason that we're all here. And that's one of the main reasons that we want to offer this open invitation. John would invite listeners to write and record essays, and he would publish those in a special essay episode, and then he'd award $100 to the winner. Well, we're not going to give away $100, but we do think that this could be a way that you could collaborate with us and help us create more episodes. So here's the proposal. If you want to work with us to be part of the podcast, first, pick a topic that you're really passionate about, and then write that up in an essay. Record yourself reading it, send it to us, and we'll publish it and invite you on for a panel discussion to talk about it. And that's a show.
No, I'm really serious. I think that's a good idea.
Just talking? Well, what's the show about?
It's about nothing.
Now, if you have problems writing the essay or recording the essay and you need some help, reach out. We can help you with that. So maybe today's episode is less of a traditional episode and more of an extended commercial. More of a way to show you rather than just tell you what these types of episodes could be. So we took some excerpts from two essays that both Tom and I submitted years ago as panelists on Mormon Expression, and we'll discuss them here today the way that we would discuss a listener essay. And there you go, that's a show. So let's get right into it as I'm joined by Randy Snyder.
You know, every time we go to bed, we die.
And Tom Perry.
I got an itchy trigger finger, man. Don't push.
And we'll start off with an excerpt from Tom's Mormon Expression essay from August 2010.
I've never reconsidered my membership in the LDS Church until about 3 years ago. I've always thought of myself very lucky and to be very blessed to be part of the, quote, one and only true church upon the face of the earth. I always wondered what I'd done in the pre-existence to be so lucky. I assumed that I must have been a valiant soldier back then, and sometimes even caught myself wondering if I fought alongside Angel Gabriel. I was unknowingly developing a kind of unintentional sense of superiority. The church, unintentionally or not, puts constant pressure on its members of never being good enough. Perfection is the goal. We must become like Christ. I think most leaders in the church don't actually realize the many negative side effects of instituting constant pressure of consistent and strict obedience required of its members. My mission is riddled with positive and negative experiences, as I'm sure most missions are. But on a whole, I look back at my mission with regret and remorse. I know that most people naturally remember the negative rather than the positive. But my negative experiences have weighed heavily on me for a long time, and some have forever changed me. But it wasn't until late 2007, when I was serving on the High Council, that I began to allow my many hidden doubts in the church to finally take a hold on me. It was then I finally faced my doubts and decided to finally confront them all head on. So I entered apologetics and began to study church history frantically. After almost a year of ingesting lots of previously unknown Mormonism and its history, I came upon one particular night where I just couldn't sleep. One particular question just kept haunting me over and over again. Could I have possibly been wrong all this time? Admitting you're wrong is one of the toughest things a person can do. In fact, some people never can admit that they're wrong. It is common and natural for most of us to unintentionally look for evidence to support what we are already committed to. I was wrong about the church. I came to the realization that it wasn't what I thought and believed it was. And it shook me to my very core. Now I approach most things with the realization that I might be wrong, but at least I'm a little more aware now, and I walk a little more carefully rather than running in a direction without noticing the upcoming cliff.
Okay, so what do we want to talk about? Because I listened to it today, and I did a lot of cringing. I did a lot of, wow, what the hell was I thinking kind of moments.
How different are you now than then?
I'd say quite a bit. I'm much more relaxed. The biggest eye-opening moment for me is when I realized that there's not a lot of people that listen to this shit. Then I stopped caring as much.
So you imagined everyone in the audience naked?
No. Oh, okay. At first, I had in the back of my mind that those podcasts were going to be so huge and so big, and gather such a large audience that, you know, I was much more self-aware and self-critical. Now I just don't give a shit because I'm much more realistic about what kind of audience we're going to get to.
Were you afraid that it was going to get to your parents and get to your bishop and just it was just going to spread like wildfire and it would be like your own tramp stamp?
Yes. Well, my very first interview on Mormon Expression got to my parents and my sister, and I had some fallout from that. So, yeah, I was really, really gun-shy.
Yeah.
And with this essay that I did, I think I was pretty sharp, I think, as far as trying to be a little hard-hitting in it.
So why did you choose the topic that you chose?
Well, I think I was a little – I don't think I had like a particular topic on that. It's kind of like it was free-flowing, some of my thoughts. If I recall right, at that point – and I even wrote like a long blog entry on a blog. I think it was on Peace Writer or something like that. about this, about the myth of objectivity and how everybody can make mistakes. It's like putting on that skeptic hat means everything's in question now. Everything. And that sucks because you're losing certainty, essentially, with the church.
And yeah, and that's something even I, the caustic, angry panelist, the villain, I guess, is what I am.
No, the teddy bear.
You're the new Tannenhill.
Oh, no. that's something I even miss. There was something comforting about having all the answers and being sure about it. That living in this new world where, you know, if somebody tells me I'm going to die in 10 seconds, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm fairly convinced that it's just going to be an eternal dial tone, but that's not comforting.
You know? Really? I think it is.
Well, at least if I do die in the next 10 minutes, I won't have to get up in the morning. I really hate getting up in the morning. I'm such an angry, cranky, miserable, depressed. I wouldn't say that. Coffee has been a wonderful blessing in my life, and it's kind of tempered that a little bit. But
I want to riff on that for a second, though. Go back to the whole dial tone thing, because I came to this realization at one point, and I don't remember exactly where it was or why, but that if there was a God, and he was really a merciful God, then the afterlife for everyone would just be oblivion. It would just be nothing. Because then there's no consciousness, there's no continued suffering. You know, like, you're not looking down at the earth and worrying about, oh, are they going to make it or not? You know what I mean? Like, tears of suffering and stuff. You're just done. Like, outer darkness, if outer darkness is like you're snuffed out and there's no more existence, phew.
Well, that only works to a certain extent. I mean, what about those guys that are total assholes in life? That means there's no justice after the fact.
Hitler
got to get out of jail.
I never worried about that anyway.
That was harder for me than anything, really, was that assholes will not get justice. That was the hardest thing
when I became an
atheist. That Hitler's not going to answer for that shit. Bullies in the world, especially the ones who have power to be a bully to the thousands and millions, like Kim Jong-il, there's no justice for those people. That was really hard to come to grips with.
Well, and then the people that are completely selfless and live a phenomenal life, it's like, okay, you get the same reward as Hitler. Congratulations.
I, at some point, I must have had a shift, you know, to where I focused more on the here and now than on the afterlife, and I don't remember where that is, but it's always, as far back as I can remember, seemed to me that the consequences for bad living is just... you're not that happy, and the consequences for good living is that you're more happy. That could be a platitude, naive.
Yeah,
naive. That sounds like a meritocracy, which is a myth.
How is it a meritocracy? I'm not familiar with that.
You're saying if you live good, then good things will come.
No. I'm not saying will come to you. I'm like, I'll give you an example. You guys know that I spent a night in jail once, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I felt that I was put there wrongly. I was wrongly accused. You know, it was the one-armed man who did it, not me.
I didn't kill my wife. I don't care.
And I was angry, and I was plotting my revenge. You know, what could I do? And you know, 24 hours is a long time sitting there in that room with all the people that were in there. It was crazy.
Yeah, so you must have filled up a spiral notebook of plans and ideas.
I didn't have a spiral notebook, but it didn't take me very long, like going down the path of, okay, I could do this for revenge, I could do this for revenge, I could do this for revenge, and nothing brought me any sense of peace or happiness until I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to let this go. I'm gonna move on with my life after this as if this hasn't happened. I'm gonna learn, you know, and I started looking at this experiences as, you know, wow, how many people get a chance, you know, especially with my kind of inquisitive mind, get a chance to experience this on the inside with like minimal consequence. You know, like I'm not going to be here for very long, but I get to see what it's like.
But and your reaction is very wise and mature. I think if I were put in that situation, I think I'd be plotting out revenge, and I wouldn't feel like I could achieve peace until I could have some sort of act of vengeance that would make me feel better.
I don't know. I just looked down like a domino effect, like the different consequences of any of those vengeful actions, and I'm like, they're not going to lead me to any place where I'm going to be happy with myself. And so I...
Well, perhaps the 24 hours of nothing but reflection was quite an advantage for you.
Yeah.
If you'd only had like two or three hours, maybe you would have...
But what I'm saying is it didn't take me the entire 24 hours to come to that point. It took a couple hours of suffering, and then, you know, the rest of it was more tolerable because I was at peace with that part of it. It still sucked, but I, just in response to the meritocracy, I mean, do you see the difference between those two things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. When you came across her after said incident, didn't a rush of those feelings, the initial, I hate you, didn't come back? See, in my mind, I'm thinking that would, but okay.
No. And in fact, you know, this was part of when I went through my divorce, and it kind of crystallized to me. All right, this marriage is over. And, you know, my biggest terror was what's going to happen with my kids. And I wanted to pass the feelings of like peace that I felt onto them the best way that I knew how. So I gave them father's blessings. And I explained to them, you know, the best that I could, you know, with the ages that they were, like, I don't believe that there's any outside power or outside force that's, you know, acting on you here. This is just you and me, you know, all of us here in this room having this conversation, and any feelings of peace that you have from this are going to come from within. But we did it, you know, we went through the motions, we did it. And it was really a cathartic ritual for me. I don't know, but it was part of that peace, with it. So
I think that's really, really cool. I think it's really, really,
I don't know
cool.
how this came from the dial tone, but you know, anyway, this is our tangent. So
yeah, I for by and large, for the most part, I do think I do a good job of living in the here and the now. But there are moments, a lot of them are in the middle of the night, where I'll have the occasional existential crisis. You know, every time we go to bed, we die. You know, our consciousness, we go unconscious, and there's no guarantee that we'll wake up. And so sometimes when I
hope you're not freaking the hell out of some really paranoid listeners right now. Like they're laying in bed wide eyed. I can't go to sleep now. Yeah. Randy says I'm gonna die.
Well, we do die every time we go to bed. And it's not that scary.
Every time we go to bed. Are you a literalist or are you like figurative here? We die every time we go to sleep.
No, it's kind of like an analogy of death. Okay. I'm not saying that. Obviously, we breathe and our beats and we dream.
Yeah. No, you said it twice, pretty emphatically. No, we die every time we go to sleep. We die.
No, but when you're in deep sleep, not REM sleep, but when you're in deep sleep, consciously, it's pretty close to the same thing as actual death. You're not aware of anything. You're just completely oblivious. And
some people's spirits can travel like the globe,
yeah,
with astral projection and what's that sleep thing where they can control what they're doing, the lucid dreaming.
Yeah. I want to try that.
Have you not tried it? Oh, if you can get it to work, dude, it's pretty awesome.
Oh yeah. The amount of sex, the amount of tail I could get.
Oh, see, I was thinking I just become Neo, dude. I stop bullets right in their tracks. It's awesome.
Actually, what I would do is I'd want to fly. My favorite dreams, the ones that I remember.
Cue the Rage Against the Machine music.
Yeah, and I'm just flying over the buildings in New York City, and it's just awesome.
All right, so are we done with my thing? Or we?
Oh, hell no.
Oh, my gosh. All right.
So the topic you picked is pretty, I mean, that's pretty central. You're talking about your faith crisis. So, I mean, I can see why you went with this direction. Glenn went with the more clever direction.
Put that in quotes.
Yeah. I did the air quotes. You just couldn't hear it.
Yeah, the air bunnies on it, yeah.
Yes. But yours was just more straightforward, heartfelt, and cut to the core of the issue. And that was kind of cool to just kind of get a peek into your dark night of the soul.
Well, it's not too often that I get like that serious, but it seemed like at the time I was doing a lot of self-reflecting, and I remember writing a lot during that time. But for the most part, even when I listened to it today, I thought, why the hell am I so serious? Not one joke? What an asshole. Not once. That was kind of crappy. I mean, what a downer. It's like, oh, wow, look at this guy.
Yeah, you mentioned in it that you said you felt like a dupe. How strong was that feeling of betrayal and feeling like an idiot?
Oh, it was huge. I remember, who was I? I was talking to somebody who I had a great deal of respect for. I think it was my bishop at the time. He's just a phenomenal, phenomenal, smart, articulate guy. And even though I respected him and I kind of put him on a pedestal to begin with, I mean, I felt like a worm in his presence at that point, even though in one circumstance I felt like I knew more as far as like the gospel and the church and all that stuff. But he had such a great deal of certainty and I had like none. It sucks. I mean, because he was confident. He had his chest up. You know, I'm just cowering around the door thinking, I hope nobody sees me because this sucks. I got nothing.
Well, in the culture of the church, doubt is actually a sin. Like one of the perfect books that captures this in the Mormon culture is Sherry Dew's No Doubt. There is no doubt that we're right. And you got to expel all feelings of doubt. Doubt is I was once told by a bishop that doubt, I got it backwards.
Well, Monson had that quote in a conference talk that like faith and doubt can't exist in the same mind.
I'm sure more than just one general authority said that. It sounds familiar.
Yeah. So the church is definitely selling certainty, and it's almost disorienting to find yourself, boom, outside of that paradigm, and suddenly you're in a world with nothing but doubt.
Well, and one of the most insulting things as I went through this process, and I'm sure you guys know what this feels like, is when people would come up to you, you know, like family, friends, people that are still believing members of the church, and they look at you like you made this decision, that you made this decision to stop believing, like you just flipped the switch.
Choice.
Yeah, it's insulting to me because I felt like, you know, there was a freight train running, you know, 100 miles an hour on these tracks, and I was trying to pull it to slow down or stop at every turn, every opportunity I could to try to stop this, until I eventually had to get off the tracks and say, okay, I have to just let this thing go. It just feels inevitable. I mean, it really does feel...
But even in that example that you said, you made the choice to get off the tracks.
You have to.
Isn't that a decision? Yeah, but why be upset with people?
What?
Why be upset with people for saying you made this decision to get off the tracks when you did? You made the decision
because
to get off the tracks.
It's so psychologically taxing to stay on the tracks, to try to make it work even though, you know, you have all these doubts and uncertainty. And especially when you start making clear decisions like, okay, the church is no longer what it claims. Once you let that claim settle in, to try to still put on this facade and still live in cognitive dissonance all the time, you can do it. I mean, people do it all the time, but I'm not saying that it comes with a great cost. It's not, I don't know how to explain it. It's,
Glenn, do you think it's a choice to not believe, or is it just kind of like Tom saying there's like a momentum that happens and you get to a point where the genie's out of the bottle and you can't put that sucker back in and still be authentic and honest?
No, I disagree with that. I think you can still be authentic and honest. even if you're deluding yourself.
What?
No. Deluding yourself. I mean, that's a different thing. I mean, you're
if you believe, okay, I want to tie this to the other claim that Tom makes in his essay, that there's this constant pressure in the church for perfection. Okay, so perfection is the ultimate aim. It's a value. Mm. So anything that gets you there, anything that gets you to perfection, is justified. Even so, if you've got these nagging doubts in the back of your mind, you hear this analogy all the time. You just put it on the shelf.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually the shelf gets too heavy, it breaks. Yeah, but there are people who can make that conscious decision. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to open that book. I mean, I've talked to people. I'm not going to say who, but who have said, I don't even want to read that book. I don't want to know those things because I don't want to have to struggle with the doubt. And I know that I'll still struggle with the doubt.
But so once you have read the book, is it a choice anymore?
I still think there are people who I think you see it in apologetics all the time. They learn how to what's the phrase where your mind is like a gymnast or whatever, you know?
It's mental gymnastics, and
mental gymnastics.
But what they specialize in is plausible deniability.
There you go.
But
you're making a much more succinct argument for it than I am. I'm stumbling all over the place. But the
toll psychologically that does on a person. Some people are probably wired to be able to handle that sort of thing. Me, no. I mean, I tried it for quite a while. I think I tried it a lot longer than I should have, until I finally just said, okay, for my mental well-being, just so I can close my eyes without hearing the scream, I have to be able to live in one place. I have to be right with myself.
Yeah.
Because if you live with this contradiction all the time, you know, best of luck to you, brother.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's personality makeup makes a big difference. But
yeah,
ultimately, there's a point where you don't choose not to believe. You just don't believe. You can't believe based on the evidence.
Exactly.
I guess where I take issue with that, Randy, is like generalizing that for every single person. Like, I agree there are people who are like that. But if you're taking that personality claim, then you've also got to allow that there's going to be people who see what they're doing as this mighty virtue. And damn it, I can't remember. Sisyphus.
Dan Witherspoon.
Yeah. They're Sisyphus. They're holding this rock up. And the heavier the rock gets, the more of a badass they are holding up all the doubt. And, I mean, I used to feel that way about myself. I used to say this to people that, you know, like the more doubt weight I have on my shoulders, the stronger I'm going to be. So load it on, brother. Well, load on the doubt.
And
I'll just continue to have faith. And, you know, like when I was a high school student in seminary, I remember thinking the prophet could come out tomorrow and say that the Book of Mormon is not true. It's a fraud. It's all a fraud. And I wouldn't believe him. I would still have faith. That's how resolute my testimony is, and you know,
valiant that would damage this testimony. It is ironclad.
Well,
and then you load up and you load up and you load up, and so to me it was a choice, because I felt like you're describing, Tom, I can totally relate to that, because that was my experience with it too. I just didn't want to live there. I didn't want to be like one foot in, one foot out. But I did that for a long time, and I think there are people who do that and make it work, and it can be a choice for them.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't mean to make it sound like I was trying to generalize everybody.
So, you know, another thought that came to my mind with this constant pressure for perfection, it just seems so ironic to me that Mormon could be so universalist with the degrees of glory in the afterlife, that even the lowest degree of glory is a degree of happiness.
Well, maybe Mormonism was early on.
Yeah.
And then it evolved into this capitalistic kind of thing.
Is it capitalism?
Today, Mormonism today is capitalistic.
Yeah, but I mean, is this idea of perfection, is that a capitalist idea?
No, I mean, I think Joseph Smith was railing against the, you know, pulpit pounding hellfire and damnation rhetoric of his time. And so he created, like you said, a more universalist, fair and happy afterlife than the traditional Christian afterlife.
Fair enough, but sometimes some of that hellfire damnation stuff would creep in. So, you know, I don't know.
It's in the Book of Mormon all over the place.
You're right. No, it is there. And so, even outer darkness is basically where people go who reject Joseph Smith. I mean, that's kind of like rejecting, you know, okay, you're not following me, you're going to outer darkness. So it's not like there wasn't a hell. But you know, what would be the effect on a ward? You know, you're in Sunday school or elders' quorum or whatever, and people are talking about sin, and you're like, you know what? It's okay. People who go to the celestial kingdom, they're going to be happy. It just ends the conversation. Like, no one's going to accept that.
No, because...
No one's going to accept... at all, and they'll be like, that is a very dangerous position to take.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope, because once you start accepting even minor sins, next thing you know, you're accepting the major sins.
Yeah, but Jesus died for all the sins, you know? I mean, it's taken care of.
Well, not all of them.
Yeah, there's all these, like, catches that come in that have to... And to me, it's all about protecting this elitist sense of importance that... You can't be saved unless we say so. Unless we, you know, I think I've said this before, that like the atonement of Christ is dormant until the Mormon priesthood activates it.
Yeah, well, I shouldn't say Jesus doesn't forgive all sins, because in Mormonism, Jesus does forgive all sins. But yeah, you have to...
But obedience to you, what...
you have to come, yeah, you have to go up to him with the... clipboard and a checklist to make sure all the boxes are checked first.
Yeah, but these are all of the built-in checks and balances for the power of the Mormon Church.
Right. You need need you to need them to be the vehicle to the afterlife.
Yeah.
It increases revenue each quarter.
Well, I don't even think it's completely a money thing. I think there's more to it than money. But that to me is what's driving this pressure for perfection. So I just wanted to have that conversation. Is all.
Glenn, how many more drops of blood are you going to cause Jesus to suffer retroactively?
Yeah, right.
He sweat out every pore, so there's room.
I don't know.
I cut someone off. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, do you disagree with the perfection thing that I stated? Or, because it sounds like you had thoughts and maybe you were going to challenge it or something?
Oh, no. I agree with it. Okay. There absolutely is. I just think it's ironic that that's the attitude of members. It's the attitude of the church. And yet we have this very nice degrees of glory thing built into our scriptures that says... Even the lowest degree of glory is happiness and no sickness, and it's a world that's much better than here. And you know, the idea of progression between kingdoms, that's been kicked around. It's never been officially acknowledged, because we can't let people think that, you know, you've got a chance at the brass ring unless you play exactly by our rules. You know, it's a dichotomy in the religion that I find fascinating. Mainly because I don't choose to believe it anymore. I threw that in for you, Randy.
You choose to do things that could lead to disbelief, but there comes a point where you can't choose it. I just, that's what I believe. You know, the perfection culture for a lot of people is not a big deal, because some people are just really good at self-deluding themselves that they're better than they really are.
Fake it till they make it, yeah.
But there's people like me that are a little more, you know, I'm pretty self-aware. That's one of the reasons why I suffer from so much anxiety, is I'm, you know, professionally, as a person, I'm almost acutely, I'm too aware of my flaws and my weaknesses. And I beat myself up over it all the time. I talk to myself constantly out loud in front of the mirror, shaving and brushing my teeth. My wife's, after 16 years, has just gotten used to it. But, you know, my makeup in a perfection culture was toxic. It was constant cycles of self-loathing, finding redemption, but it was always temporary, and then self-loathing, and then repeat, rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
All right, Glenn, so tell us about your hard-hitting, award-winning humor piece with your testimony. essay.
You really thought it was an award-winning piece?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know if you actually got an award for it, but you should have.
I never did. No. Mm. No.
I'd like to bear my testimony. I know the church is. I know that Joseph Smith was, and that he had, and that he did, and that sometimes I wish that I could too. I know that President Monson is the president of our church, and that the Liahona was round, and that the sword of Laban was sharp, and that the golden plates were shiny. I know the road is narrow, and the yoke is easy, and that many are called. I know that we must all endure until... I know that folklore is more than just Paul Bunyan. I know that religious devotion is created and defended and is often more important than kindness or compassion or tact. I know that memorats are personal narrative accounts of first-hand experiences with the bizarre and supernatural, that they maintain and validate and justify belief. I know that emotion is powerful and real, and that memory is malleable. I know that false dichotomies are false. I know that magic is the idea that we can bind invisible powers to our own personal will. I know that when I pray, that I'm speaking, and when I bless, that I'm comforting, and when I fast, that I'm hungry. I know that the priesthood is for all worthy males who are both worthy and male. I know that Dumbo's special feather was black. I know that three patterns give a sense of wholeness and correctness and completion, be they structures of society, concepts of divinity, or simple patterns of speech. I know that people all too easily confuse the symbol for the idea and reify abstraction and cling desperately to the absurd. I know that my perspective and delivery is often offensive and threatening and repulsive to many who would otherwise be my parents or my wife or my friends. I'm thankful for my pain-in-the-neck Japanese mission and for my remarkable accredited BYU education and for the many leaders of the church throughout my life who have set such clear and concrete examples of what I should and should not be. I'm thankful for Jesus' example of love and forgiveness and peace, and that he reproached the Pharisees even more than I do. I'm thankful that he hasn't struck me down with lightning yet. I'm thankful that he taught in parables and didn't care if the prodigal son was really prodigal or if the good Samaritan was really real. I'm thankful for Noah and the way he squeezed all those animals into the ark and that he saved the flying reindeer. I'm thankful for Jonah's message to the Ninevites and that great fish have such weak and slow digestion and that he could escape and become a real boy. I'm thankful for the Tower of Babel and for Mahanrai and for 16 glowing stones. I'm thankful that Ammon chopped off all those arms. I'm thankful that agency is free, that warmth can be Luke, and that I have such a comfortable fence to sit on. I'm thankful that the glory of God is intellectual. Wait. I'm thankful for this church and for the many lessons it has taught me and for the many lessons it will continue to teach me as I pull, by gradual Sundays, the clinging hairs, even the hairs out of my very clinging head, in painful, bloody clumps. And these things I say because I still don't know when to just shut up. Eminem.
You know, it's funny. I listened to it with my wife tonight, and you know, we're newly married. It's been since April.
Did she just leave? She just left you after hearing this?
No, okay, no, no. Good. She laughed at it, you know, and she said, "This doesn't sound like you anymore." Like,
that's what I was. That was my biggest impression when I'm listening to something. Like,
really?
This guy has evolved, man. This doesn't sound like the Glenn that I talked to recently.
So I'll compare your answer to hers. So what's different?
You seem to have a lot more affection for the institution than you do now. You seem to be a little bit more open-minded to the possibility of metaphysics than you are now.
I think I intentionally made it sound that way because I was straddling the worlds that Tom just described. You know, that's where I was 3 years ago.
I can't believe I used the term open-minded.
Yeah, well, you were throwing it back in my face.
You seemed more credulous. Yeah. That's a better word.
Yeah. You know, and that's what Krista said as well, that and now people are going to think that my wife is Krista the psychic. No, it's a different Krista. But
is it?
I don't know. Maybe channeling. Dude, you could have a menage a trois. If Krista can channel Krista in your bedroom, damn.
Well,
this Krista doesn't channel though. Anyway, but she thought that I'm more direct now, that I don't like circumnavigate and like wink wink and try to be clever with language and double meanings and hidden things, because there's a lot of I when I listen to this essay, it is packed, dense with stuff.
Yeah, it's like 51 liners, man. You want me to take notes on this thing? I gave up after about a minute and a half. I'm like, it's just one liner after one liner after one liner.
You took notes. All my notes consisted of eye roll, eye roll.
Thanks. Yeah.
Or Tom sigh.
Everything that I had been like learning about in, you know, academic previous to that, everything that kind of like nudged me along, you know, like Memorats or the malleability of memory, or, you know, things like the culture versus the gospel and all the circular logic and circular speak that's in the church, things like symbols, you know, mistaking symbols for real things, and topics like reification, which I've never really talked about what I mean by reification, but it was all the stuff that was neatly, tightly packed in this that meant something to me, but I never knew, you know, if somebody listening to it would get any of it, because I don't know, like, to me it's like an atom bomb waiting to explode. And so maybe what you're seeing now 3 years later is the, you know, Hiroshima or something, I don't know. The explosion.
I did have, because it wasn't the first minute and a half, you said something, I believe that Joseph Smith did yada yada yada. And then you followed up with, sometimes I wish I could too. Does that mean you would like to have sex with lots of women and teenagers?
It was intentionally left to be vague so that you could fill in whatever you wanted to there. And I had different things in my mind. I mean, seeing God and Jesus, you know, having those kinds of experiences, the Book of Mormon, that sort of thing. Like, all my life I wished that I could have those kinds of experiences. Absolutely. But yeah, I remember, because I did this when I was living in Japan, and I was still active in the ward in Japan. I was kind of semi-active in the ward in Japan. I had a hard time going to sacrament meeting. I went to Elders Quorum maybe twice, and then I just couldn't go back. And I got a calling in the primary teaching my daughter, and so that was my mainstay in the church at that point. But this lesson in Elders Quorum that was like one of my last, they were talking about Joseph Smith and what a great guy he was. And I'm like, I've been reading all this Todd Compton stuff and Bushman, and, you know, that Joseph Smith, he was spreading his seed around, you know, he was getting around, and like, wouldn't that be nice to be able to get around and not have any negative consequences for it? And, you know, 200 years later, people are singing your praises as the saint, you know, so
praise to the man.
Exactly. So yeah, that was, unspokenly implied in what I was, that I was,
so
kind
it was
of what
it
I was going for.
Was it really about the sex, or was it about the power? I think the power would be something that most people would thirst after, because the amount of power Joseph Smith had over people, that would be very intoxicating.
Yep. Just ask Kumari.
Yep. Right? Definitely. Yeah. I think one of the other things, I was coming off of an experience with my dad where I created a list of like all the things that I didn't like about the church. It was like 47 things. And
okay, Martin Luther.
Well, right, yeah. And then I'm like, oh man, I better balance this out with things that I do like about the church too, so that it's not just this heavy brick that I'm dropping on.
Along with Scott list.
Yeah.
It was 5 hours long. So that's good.
Yeah. No, it was a long list. I think there were 25 or 26, you know, I couldn't get it even, but the things, you know, there were good things, because there were things that I like about the teachings as well, but he only focused on the negative stuff, and it was just this huge rift between he and I, and, you know, it was kind of like the
your dad's a McConkie Mormon, man.
He is, yeah, he totally is. But he's a Nibley Mormon and a McConkie Mormon, and
a Packer.
I don't know if he's so Packer or not. He might be a little of that. But Jeffrey Holland, when he was accused by the guy from the BBC doing that interview of, you know, like he said, oh, well, people have told me that it's a cult.
Well, I guess if that's what they believe, it's probably a good thing they chose to leave it, because we're not a cult. I'm not an idiot. You know, I've read a couple of books, and I've been to a pretty good school. And I have chosen to be in this church because of the faith that I feel and the inspiration that comes.
No, I'm not calling you a cult. I'm just saying that I've met people who used to be in the church.
I've met people. And if people want to call us a cult, they can call us a cult, and you can call us a cult. But we are 14 million and growing, and I'd like to think that your respect for me would be enough to know that this man doesn't seem like a dodo.
That was exactly my dad's response to what I said to him, that I was calling him an idiot, and so he just reacted very defensively.
One of my closest friends pulled that card on me. He had this down look on his face. We golfed 18 holes, and at the end of it, he finally got the courage to ask me, or to tell me, my biggest concern in our friendship is that you're now going to think I'm an idiot because I still believe this stuff. Yeah. Like, no, my IQ hasn't changed since I left the church. It's not a matter of intelligence.
No, but I've heard you say things before that it comes down to bad thinking.
Yeah. Well, and bad thinking is something we all do all the time.
Yeah.
It's
some people more than others, though. Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of obvious.
That's a little condescending to say that somebody's, you know, like bad thinking. And I could see how that could be simplified into saying, or somebody thinking that you're calling them an idiot.
No, it's simple. It's counterintuitive. Critical thinking is not intuitive. If we use critical thinking in every step of our life, we'd be paralyzed. You know, you have to use heuristics, which are cognitive shortcuts, just to get around, just to exist in a social group. So anyway, okay. I want to take us on a little bit of a tangent.
Okay.
You guys had one thing that was common between the two of you that I noticed.
Whoa, really?
You both seem to not look back at your mission very fondly.
Wait, no. As far as I understand, Glenn loved his mission.
No, what was the exact line you used in this, Glenn?
I don't remember.
Oh, come on.
Pain in the butt, Japanese mission, something like that?
Your mission was a big pain in the ass.
Yeah, it was.
You don't remember that, Tom?
I guess
Tom knows more about he's forgotten more about my mission than...
That line. That line stood out to me. I didn't know that... I knew there were some things that annoyed you about your mission based on your Voices interview.
Yeah.
But I never got the impression that you would kind of generalize it as a pain in the ass.
No, it was. It was super hard.
There it is. That's the way I see it. You say it was hard, but you also think it was very, very rewarding.
I'm glad that I went through that experience because I grew from it, you know, and it opened up my eyes to a lot of things. But yeah, there was a time, like I remember one night specifically, I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I've never had that since. And it was probably me just being a drama queen to myself, you know, but I just, I was so stir crazy. I had a companion. I just had a series of like really difficult companions to deal with. Like the first half of my mission was almost all. I had a couple that were really nice, but
all them, right? No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
No. But this guy suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome. He couldn't get out of the apartment, and it was in July in a non-air conditioned apartment. It was just hot, and I went stir crazy. There was nothing to do. I was just bored. It was things like that. And then, you know, like the Streaking Samurai, I think you know that story. That was my trainer.
Yeah.
But part of that was because I came out of the MTC so on fire. Like I came to the mission home with two contacts for my mission president. That, you know, one was somebody in the airport in LA. That I got their, you know, just chatting up, got their address and phone number. They said, send the missionaries here. They want to hear it. And then another one was a kid on the plane going to Japan that my companion and I went through the first two discussions that we learned in the MTC, and we committed him to baptism on the plane. And I thought, this is going to be easy. This is going to be so easy.
Oh, man, did you get set up?
Oh, my gosh. It was terrible. Within the first 2 weeks, my companion, my trainer, called me the cockiest son of a bitch he had ever met in his life, and I was shattered.
Because you're supposed to be humble.
Yeah, supposed to be humble. I thought I was being humble. I always had a hard time knowing when I.
That's hilarious. It's like catching a fish on your first cast and then getting shit for like 5 hours.
Yeah,
and you can't drink.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people that I was with, they were just really jaded, and it took me a while to become equally jaded.
So, Tom, why did you find your mission hard?
Oh, I don't even know where to begin with it. I don't really look at my mission with any fondness, really.
Where did you serve?
In Peoria, Illinois.
Okay.
I had good experiences and blah blah blah, and I learned a lot. Blah, blah, blah. But it, I mean,
yada yada.
This the same horseshit that Glenn just said, except for the fact that I look at the experience with a lot of regret and remorse, and I think that I could have learned what I learned out there in any number of situations, you know, in early college or in a service mission or something else. So I hated my mission even when I came home. I just the experience was just not good. There's a lot of
go ahead.
There was just a lot of experiences that I had out there that I don't think I was prepared for. You know, like getting placed with a district leader who did some shady things with a girl, and then when I became the whistleblower, it blew up in my face. And it was a lot of blowback on that one, and it made me, it shattered me, because it broke any level of trust that I had with my mission president, with my companions, with a lot of missionaries that I thought that I trusted. There was a lot of you know, politics, knives in back kind of shit. It made me very, very jaded for a while. Probably, you know what? It made me jaded permanently. How's that?
So I'm polished those jagged edges off. I think that this is just talking out of my ass, which is what I do most of the time anyway. But
you and Jesse.
I find... Should I put the microphone to my ass real quick?
No.
Better clarity.
You haven't been already? No, I'm just kidding.
No, I served stateside as well. In fact, mine was profoundly disappointing, as I was a 6-hour drive from home. I grew up in LA and served in Phoenix, or even worse, the east side, which is like Utah Junior, where Glenn grew up. And so I find more people who have left the church who talk about their mission, more people look back at it as a net positive that went on fucking exotic foreign missions. And the guys who went stateside that leave the church look back at their mission and go, it was horrible.
Are you serious?
Yeah, because, you know, you go, at least Glenn got Japanese out of it. He got to see a culture. There's a lot of things that he can point to that you in Peoria, Illinois, and me in Mesa, Arizona, you know, we can't add that to our, you know, I was tracking in neighborhoods that were just like the ones at home. And the single most difficult thing for me on my mission was, you know, it was a heavily Mormon area. So like every third door you knocked on was a Mormon. Most people weren't home during the day. I would just like get up in the morning and go, what the hell am I going to do today to stay busy and to feel, you know, that this is of some value. Every day getting up, if we had that blank blue planner staring at me in the face, I just had this pit in my stomach, overwhelming anxiety of, what am I going to do today? How am I going to fill up 10 hours of this day?
Were you like me too, where you're thinking, not only am I letting myself down and this area down, but God himself down? I'm letting him down.
Yeah. And I'd also have the anxiety, the metaphysical anxiety, like, was that a premonition that I should have knocked on or gone down this street? Did I just miss a soul? Is that now going to be on my, is that their blood going to be on my garments?
Did you ever have that confirmed though? Like those, because you talk about the negative side of that, but did you ever have a positive side of that belief being validated?
It was confirmation bias, and it was something there was this one time we went tracking, and we did,
trust me, you don't have to explain it away to me.
But I'm just saying that because we like to have great stories, right? We all love telling these great stories. So we had this baptism. Well, what happened was my companion and I, again, it was 110 degrees and we're on our stupid bikes with our helmets and we're just driving, just had nothing to do. And so I liked to go to more poor areas because they just, you know, seemed more receptive.
Yeah. Cause they have time.
They have time and they have problems.
They have time. Yeah. And
they're looking for answers. So we just wandered. We were just kind of meandering down the street slowly on our bikes, and I finally saw an apartment complex and I said, let's go in there. And the first door we knocked on, we ended up baptizing her. Found out later that she had a crush on my companion. Mm-hmm. And that's why she joined the church. She never came to church once after she was baptized, but at her baptism, I stood up there and I said, this is proof that the Holy Ghost inspires us, because I felt a strong impression that I needed to go to that apartment complex. And lo and behold, the first door we knock on is this beautiful lady here in white.
Mm-hmm. you got that Kodak moment,
yeah,
man.
That was very powerful evidence. Yeah. You know, that this system works.
Yeah, yep. You got fodder for your testimonies after that.
Yep. You always heard others say it was the best 2 years of my life. And I was always made it a point to say, because I was honest with myself, it was not the best 2 years of my life, even as a believer. They were not fun years. And so I always said, it wasn't the best 2 years of my life, but it was the best 2 years for me. So that's how I know I really did not enjoy being a missionary in Phoenix, Arizona.
I remember hearing the testimony of a real smart aleck guy at BYU who got up and said that his mission was the best 4 months of his life. I thought that was pretty funny.
That's good.
I like that guy.
Yeah.
All right. Are we at a wrapping up point? I feel the air. Sure. I feel the air getting let out of this balloon.
Yeah. Well, I never got to reification.
What's reification?
Reification is when you take an abstract idea and you make it, you treat it as if it's a real, concrete, solid thing.
Like Noah and the Ark?
No, like the church. Like you talk about the church as if the church is a real thing, but it isn't. You can't put the church on a scale. You can't weigh it. You can't measure it. It doesn't exist. It's an idea. It's a concept that we treat as if a real thing, as if it's a real thing. We talk about it as if it's a real thing.
Uh-huh.
But it's a reified abstraction.
What's the point of that, though, Glenn? To what end does that serve? I mean,
because then you can deconstruct human construction, and it doesn't have its mystical power anymore.
Not necessarily.
I mean, for me, in my journey, it was one of those things where I started seeing the fingerprints of humanity over almost everything. I think it puts you on guard. I think, you know, going back to the the conversation about good thinking, critical thinking, I think it puts you on guard for bullshit when you hear like Sean Hannity say something like, oh, you're a good American. You know, you understand that he's using this reified construct and he's created a symbol that represents something and means something that people will buy into. And by understanding it, you don't have to buy into it. I don't know.
Yeah, I like
think
it.
That's the impact that it's had on me.
I've learned
I think there's something to it. All right, I'll give you the pass, Glenn. I'll trust you this once.
Okay.
Well, everyone that resigns from the church gets to understand, even if they don't know what reification means, they get to see the reification in process, because when you resign, you want to like go to some, you know, who's the church? Where's the church? I want to go tell you off. And what you do is you send a letter that doesn't get read by anyone that matters, may not even get read. They just look at the outline and say, okay, it's a resignation letter. I'm going to contact the stake president. There's no like person that you could go to who is the church and tell them what you think about them and what they're doing.
This leads into my fantasy, not the sex fantasy. Relax, Randy. The fantasy of me being excommunicated.
Is that really a fantasy for you?
I no kidding, dude. I dream about this a lot. And
you have a martyr complex.
Maybe. But I mostly think it's for that exact purpose that you just stated, Randy. I want to be able to state in front of my peers, some of those guys that I served with, what's changed, why I feel the same way I do now. Because I don't
want to do that in fast and testimony meeting.
No, I want to do it in that kind of environment. I want to see them squirm in their seats. Maybe
you have to do the testimony and testimony meeting first, and then they'll call you in for the excommunication.
go out in flames, dude.
Man on fire.
You can make it happen if you really want that to happen. We can help.
No, thanks.
Social costs would be huge for him.
Yeah, it would be.
He's got neighbors, right? I mean, your wards in mm-hmm. Utah County are like two blocks.
Yep, and I know most of the members of the High Council very, very personally. So yeah, it would come at a great cost, but I think I fantasize about this because if it were to happen and I went through the entire experience, which I'd be extremely prepared for, by the way. I would be ready and
a week off of work just to get fully prepared.
But I think after it was all said and done, I mean, maybe I wouldn't get excommunicated. Maybe I would. I don't know. But after the decision was made that I was exed, I think that night of sleep, I would sleep so hard and so well. It would be so worth it. And then I would wake up the next morning and try to drink another cup of coffee without it just tasting like shit. And I would be happy. I would be happy.
So you know what? I would kind of like to do this, Tom, where we have an episode where we've all prepared our statements to the High Council. And, you know, we are standing in front of them to be excommunicated and we're stating our case. Do you want to do that? Like the next iteration of essays for us is what we would say in an excommunication hearing or whatever that is.
I like the idea, but like Randy said, I'm not even like all this that I just said. I'm actually got all my fingers and toes crossed that you cut out because it's going to come at a great social cost to me. If it were to get out.
This is just like the guy who's got an asshole boss and he fantasizes about telling him off.
It is.
In front of everybody so everyone can see him. But you're not going to do it because you'll get fired.
Well, maybe one of these days. Like if someone were to push me hard enough, if someone were to do something to one of my kids or my wife or something like that, I think I would push back hard enough to make that happen. I do. I got an itchy trigger finger, man. Don't push.
So I know people are going to listen to this and say, then Tom, why aren't you just resigned? Why don't you just throw in the towel?
You missed the point, Glenn. It's not about disconnecting and disassociating himself with the church. He wants to tell the church off.
Yeah, I don't want to go out. I don't want to go out. Yeah, I don't want to write all my frustrations on a letter that won't ever get read. I want at least 15 guys in suits who think they have power over me. Yeah. I want to be able to state what I feel right then and there in front of them. And then I want them to be able to judge me, quote, judge me, if they feel like they can. That's what I want.
So let it be said, so let it be done.
You're done.
So hopefully this episode was a little more than navel-gazing part two. I really hope it illustrates the kinds of conversations that we could have around essays submitted by you, the listener. But a lot of that's up to you. If you want to come on the podcast, but you don't want to write an essay, that's no problem. Just talk to us about what you want to do, and we'll figure out a way to make it work. So don't forget the survey over at our website, www.infantsonthrones.com. And anyone for the closing prayer?
There's been a few ladies that have friend requested me on Facebook and told me how much they love listening to me talk.
Me so hard, you me love you long time.
And one of them, she's actually a PhD candidate.
So am I.
Oh, good for you. she did a recent presentation on sexuality.
Take it off.
Oh.
By the way,
right up your alley.
By the way, it's funny because she didn't know I was...
I'm putting on the Barry White music now.
Baby, take it off.
You have to edit this out.
I'm not gonna. So don't say it unless you don't want to.
No, seriously, Glenn.
I want you the way you came into the world.
Okay.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't want to feel no clothes.
She doesn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't want to see no panties.
And it's just so...
Yeah.
And take on that brassiere, my dear.